Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, we're starting to get some names expressing interest in both the NDP and Liberal leadership contests. Before the parties get there, they've got to pick interim leaders for when the House comes back. And still lots of anger in the air about the electoral system that gave the Tories 100% of the power with just 41% of the votes. And Greg Lyle joins the pod to share what he's learned about Ontario voters. It's Tuesday, June 14th, 2022, so let's get to it. JMM, it's interesting. Doug Ford's government was just re-elected 2 weeks ago, and yet it's made next to no news since then. Most of the focus has been on the opposition parties, both of which are looking for new leaders, and we're starting to see some names emerging. Let's divide our chat here into four sections. We've got names to pass along for the permanent and interim leaderships for both the New Democrats and the Liberals. So let's do that. What names are we hearing for the permanent replacement for Andrea Horvath as NDP leader?
So far, the names that we are primarily hearing are from people inside the caucus. Marit Stiles, the MPP for Davenport and education critic, is one prominent name. Catherine Fife, finance critic and MPP for Waterloo, another. Fife first elected in 2012, if I recall correctly, and has been one of the star performers for the caucus for about a decade now. Joel Hardin, the MPP for Ottawa Centre, who was elected in 2018. And I think it's fair to call him, one of the MPPs on the leftmost flank of the caucus. And so he would, if he won, take the party in a different direction. Federal MP Matthew Green, the MP for Hamilton Centre, has taken himself out of the running, said he will not run for the leadership. But there were people who were very curious to see whether he would go. And certainly he had supporters who were wishing he would. And Kristen Wong Tam, the recently elected MPP for Toronto Centre, has said she will not be a leadership candidate either.
Well, I gather in both cases it was just sort of very new to the jobs that they currently have that sort of took them out of the running. Matthew Green's only a one-term MP. Kristen Wong Tam hasn't even taken a seat yet, having just come from Toronto City Council. So lack of experience at their current jobs might have some say in that. What about for the interim leadership? I gather we have what they call breaking news here.
Yes, our colleagues at Queen's Park Briefing reported earlier today, as we report this, that the NDP caucus has picked Peter Tabbins as their choice. Now, the NDP caucus makes their recommendation to the party leadership of who they would like as the interim leader. And obviously, they have more of a voice in this decision than you or I do. But formally, that decision is going to be made later by the NDP's provincial council. It's an interesting choice. Tabbins is no neophyte at Queen's Park. He's been around there for a while. Energy critic, knows the energy file backwards and forwards, though that's not as controversial these days at Queen's Park as it used to be. But other names were suggested. Peggy Sattler is the NDP, or rather was the NDP House Leader in the last legislature. And Butila Karpoche, the Parkdale High Park MPP, another name that people had suggested as interim leader. One issue I guess I would raise is it's possible that either Sattler or Karpoche wanted the permanent job. And there's sort of the unspoken rule seems to be that if you want the interim position, you can't have the interim position and also run for the permanent one.
Indeed. Now, let's check out the Liberals. We got a bit of a surprise, actually, last Thursday when I was hosting the agenda. And Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, who was one of the guests on that discussion, he the federal MP for Beaches East York, well, he fessed up during our discussion that he was looking at the permanent leadership. And after the show was over, we kicked around some other names from the federal scene. You got former MP Navdeep Bains on the list. There are current MPs Yasser Naqvi, Mark Holland, or Michael Cotto, who of course came second to Stephen Del Duca in 2020. Their names were mentioned. Josh Matlow, Toronto City Councillor, mulling a run. Mississauga Mayor Bonnie Crombie would have considerable support if she were interested. She hasn't said anything publicly about that yet. Barrie's mayor, Jeff Lehman, would have been a very strong contender, maybe even a front runner, if not for the fact that he lost his attempt to win a seat on June the 2nd to the Attorney General in his Barrie-Springwater-Oro-Medonte riding. And in fact, Mayor Lehman had the smallest margin of defeat in the whole province, just a few hundred votes. He may consider running for the leadership anyway, but not having a seat, certainly, as we saw with Stephen Del Duca, can be an issue, certainly in the minds of some. What about, though, let me get you to turn your attention to the current caucus of 8 MPPs at Queen's Park. Any permanent leadership aspirants there?
Well, one of the obvious examples is Mitzi Hunter, who ran for the leadership against Stephen Del Duca in 2020 and obviously did not win then, but maybe she wants to give it another try again. You know, the discussion of which direction to take the party, I think representing women and visible minority voters is still going to be an important issue for the party as they move forward. And Mitzi Hunter is a Black woman from Scarborough. These are, you know, important factors that you would consider in any leadership race. But also a relatively new MPP, Stephen Blais, has made some remarks to reporters about how he would like to play a larger leadership role in the party as it rebuilds from its current state. He is, you know, an Ottawa area MPP. He, as I say, relatively new, was only elected in a by-election since 2018. So he's one of the most junior members of the Liberal caucus, but perhaps he has a lean and hungry look about him, if I can quote Julius Caesar, and would like to move up in the ranks.
Now, for the interim leadership, obviously, we've got to be looking at one of those eight as well, who are currently looking at going to Queen's Park, but almost all of them are new. So what's the betting there?
Well, it could be deja vu for John Fraser all over again. For the sin of being an extremely reliable, strong performer, he may be asked to be the interim leader again. He did it the last time after Kathleen Wynne stepped down as leader. You know, just really beloved and admired by his caucus for the job he did as interim leader. And, you know, Kathleen Wynne said some really wonderful things about him in her farewell speech about the job he did to make space for her in the caucus as a vanquished leader, if I can put it that way. He won his seat handily, so you know, he could play that role again. I know we just spoke about her, but you know, the other name that is coming up is Mitzi Hunter as the interim leader. Now, again, we just talked about you can't really do the interim leader and be running for the permanent leader unless you had, you know, the entire party behind you, I guess. You know, that'll give us a sign, really, of whether Ms. Hunter is actually considering a run at the permanent gig, is whether she starts to talk seriously about being the interim leader.
Can I lay some really seriously arcane Queen's Park Liberal Party politics trivia on you right now?
I couldn't stop you if I wanted.
Well, if John Fraser were to be chosen as the interim leader, he would therefore have been the Ontario interim leader twice. That's a long way from the record of who has been the Liberal leader the most times. And the answer to that question is Robert Nixon, who's still alive at the age of 93. Bob Nixon won the Liberal leadership in 1967. He then lost two straight elections, one to John Robarts and Bill Davis, so he stepped down. But then after he stepped down, his polling numbers started to do well. So the party said to him, actually, rescind your step down. We want you to stay on the job. So he ran for the leadership and got his old job back. So he was two-time Liberal leader at that point. And then after Stuart Smith stepped down, he assumed the interim leadership on that occasion. And then after David Peterson stepped down, he assumed the interim leadership again on that occasion because he was an MPP for 30 years. So he is the four-time Ontario Liberal leader, and that, my friend, has got to be a record, never mind in Ontario, but in North America, a four-time leader of a single political party. What do you think?
I have enough respect for John Fraser that I would not wish that fate upon him.
There you go. Well, I'm not sure about what kind of emails you're getting these days or what you're seeing on social media, but I am getting a lot of stuff from people who are very unhappy with the current system we have for electing politicians, which, of course, is the same system we have used since Confederation. I'm talking, of course, about what we lovingly call first past the post.
The former political science student in me is interjecting here to say that formally, you can also call it the single-member plurality system. Each riding only elects one member to the legislature, and each member only needs to be elected by the largest number of votes for any candidate, even if that is not a majority. Hence, single members elected with a plurality. That's as opposed to ranked ballots or runoffs or proportional representation.
Right. Now, the strength of first past the post is that it does tend to elect majority governments who don't get the majority of the votes. And the upside of that is that they are able to make decisions and then be held accountable for the decisions that they make. The downside of that is that you get situations like we have now had for a couple of elections in a row, where the Ford government got 41% of the 43% of the people that voted, and yet they have 100% of the power because they won a majority government. And it's actually a little worse than the way I've just described it, because the actual numbers suggest that they got 41% of the 43% who voted. So in essence, they only got less than 20% of the eligible vote, but again, 100% of the power. So there's a lot of unhappiness among progressives about that situation, but is there anything that can be done about it?
Well, it would seem not for the next 4 years. There is no appetite by the Progressive Conservative Party generally or Ford personally to change the system that he inherited, that he has benefited from. You know, having said that, you know, there was also no real push to change the electoral system 8 years ago when Kathleen Wynne won a majority government with an even narrower margin. She won 38% of the 51% who voted. So again, less than 20% of the votes, and yet, in effect, 100% of the power. With there being no real sign of any structural change to our electoral system on the horizon, some people like former Liberal MPP Greg Sorbera have floated the idea of getting the New Democrats and Liberals to merge, thereby creating one big progressive party on the center-left. If we can't change the rules, we can at least change the players. So far, very little pickup of that idea.
Well, one reason might be, since Kathleen Wynne became the premier, and this we're going back now to 2013, the Ontario Liberals have moved significantly to the left, to the point where there are many longtime party activists who prefer the party more in the center, and they don't recognize their party as being distinguishable from the NDP anymore. And that is propelling Sorbera's quest to have the parties merge, since they are more similar now ideologically than they've ever been. But there is the backlash from many party members who want the party back in its more traditional moderate middle. They called it the activist center, talking more about economic development, not just how to carve up the pie more equitably. The NDP, for what it's worth, has shown absolutely no interest in merging with the Liberals. They tend to see the Liberals as the same as the Tories, and thus no appetite that we can see so far to join with them.
I would just add to that, I mean, one of the reasons why the Liberal Party has gone left is that, you know, Kathleen Wynne brought a lot of young Liberals to the party, and those people, believed in her positions, and they were very enthusiastic about them, and they haven't gone anywhere. They still self-identify as Liberals. And so to bring the party to the right, you sort of have to win the fight inside the Liberal Party. But it's also like there's an age difference we're talking about here, where you effectively have the older parts of the party waging a battle against the younger parts of the party. And it'll be fascinating to see who wins that one. But Steve, on the agenda last Thursday, you floated the idea of a non-aggression pact for the election, or for the next election, rather. The idea being that the Liberals wouldn't run in seats that the NDP won, the NDP wouldn't run in seats that the Liberals had won, and whoever came second to the Tories in all of those Tory-held ridings would get the right to run candidates in those ridings again, but the other party would stand down and not run candidates in the hopes of not splitting the progressive vote. How did that go down at the table?
Well, not well, that's for sure. Nobody on that show wanted to pick up that baton and run with it. Same problems. Both the NDP and the Liberals believe that they are the right and proper progressive alternative to the Tories. And so neither wants to defer to the other when it comes to facing the Conservatives. It's also, I know there's a tendency to say that you can sort of lump this whole center-left progressive vote into one bucket, and it's really not the case. It's very unclear that the Liberal and NDP vote would be interchangeable. Many Liberals would sooner vote Conservative than for the NDP because they believe the NDP is much too far to the left, too tied to unions, too tied to equity-seeking groups at the expense of the moderate middle. And similarly, some traditional NDP supporters, as we saw on June the 2nd, would not vote Liberal as their second choice, but rather Conservative, because they saw Doug Ford making a big outreach to the blue-collar vote. So many formerly NDP ridings, as we will talk about in a moment with Greg Lyle, they flipped to the PCs this time as a result. All of which is to say, even with the opportunity of both opposition parties needing new leaders at the moment, theoretically opening the window for merger talks or some kind of cooperation agreement, there seems to be not much appetite for either scenario at the moment. Now, could there be behind-the-scenes talks away from all the prying eyes of media people like you, McGrath? Well, I suppose that's always possible, but certainly the public statements have all been quite negative about those ideas. Well, let's stay on the election track now. Greg Lyle is president of the Innovative Research Group. He was watching election night very closely, like us all. Greg, first of all, welcome back to our little podcast here, and we're going to talk about some of your findings, such as this one I found just completely inexplicable. More people engaged a year ago than a month ago in this election campaign. How is that possible?
A year ago, we had hundreds of people dying with the fear that even more would soon perish. And we had some very dramatic back and forth from the provincial government. And it was a moment that could have been the end of Doug Ford. You know, we had a huge amount of people paying attention. We had 73% saying that they were following at least somewhat closely what Doug Ford had been doing. He had some pretty serious issues emerging, right? And what was striking there is 40% of people that woke up in the morning and felt like conservatives agreed with the statement that it was the government's decision that was directly responsible for the spike in COVID cases. So that could have been it for him. And obviously, their initial response didn't go over well. But when he did the second reversal and, you know, apologized, said he was sorry, we had, at that time, 39% of the electorate saying that Doug Ford has accepted responsibility for his mistakes and is taking steps to do better. And that taking steps to do better is a really important part of that statement. So we screwed up. Everyone saw he screwed up. There was no pretending he didn't screw up, and he didn't pretend. And that's unique, right? Like, if you go across, I mean, has Justin Trudeau said he made any mistakes at all in COVID? So, you know, the lesson there is not that leaders don't make mistakes. The lesson is when it's undeniable, don't deny it. And the last thing is at the time, it wasn't quite as high as the number that said he's trying to do better, but 36% agreed Doug Ford has done his best to balance public health concerns with economic needs.
Moving forward to just the last few weeks, what promises from the campaign appeared to have meaningfully swayed voters?
Well, I'm not sure that it was specific promises. I think it was what the narrative said about politicians, right? So one thing that is a traditional Doug Ford, Rob Ford narrative is this war on the car. One of the things I wonder is to what degree do people in the New Democratic campaign war room and the Liberal war room, to what degree do they depend on their cars, right? Because 28% of Ontarians say they use their car more than once a day, and 34% use it more than half the week. And if you're using the car that much, there are a bunch of things that you might like, but you feel are necessary. And there are a bunch of things that you might think would be nice to have that you think are annoyances, right? So it's hard to be really excited about bike lanes on Yonge Street if you're driving down Yonge Street all the time. And one of the things to bear in mind is that so many people in the suburbs of Toronto, which have been like the city of Toronto, right? So I'm talking like Etobicoke, Scarborough, North York. So many of those people get in their cars to go downtown where the war room people seem to live. And so they watched those people on their bikes and walking and doing whatever they're doing to get to work. But in the meantime, they're still stuck in their cars. And then they go back to Etobicoke, Scarborough, and North York and vote Tory. Right.
Greg, I want to ask you about another segment of the electorate. You call them the laptop class. These are people who spend their days on their laptops, and traditionally they tend to vote liberal. They clearly didn't this time. How come?
Sure. And that was an interesting thing. That came, I didn't like sit in my lonely writer's garret and come up with that. It's scrawled on the walls of like it's graffiti now in Toronto. That's how it came to me. A friend of mine in Toronto said, did you see this graffiti on the laptop class? And so it's the opposite of the laptop class. Is all the people for whom it was not an option to take their laptop home and continue to work, right? They're working on a non-automated, factory floor or, you know, doing something, working, framing a new house, which we would all love to see more, all those sorts of things. And so that turned out to be hugely significant. And I thought there might be something there, but it's dramatic. People that don't use their computers very much or at all, only 10% of those people voted liberal. But if you're on your computer all day long, 31% voted liberal. And if you just go from working on your computer all day long to just working on a computer most of the day, if you are at all free to leave your computer, the liberal vote drops from 31 to 24. So it's really, really an issue for the liberals. Most people use their computers some of the day, but again, it drops down very significantly, very quickly from being on the computer every minute of the day to being on the computer just most of the day.
And can you tell what it was about the Liberal campaign that just didn't turn the laptop group on?
Well, I think that there's just a sensibility. If we go back to that initial discussion about finding the right balance between, keeping the economy going and fighting COVID, for people that were sitting at home working on a computer all day long, who really didn't notice much of a difference other than you can socialize in the same way. And if you had kids you had to become a teacher and all the rest of that, which is no small thing. But generally, the people that either had to go to work during COVID or couldn't go to work and got laid off, those people recognize that there was an actual real struggle, that it was not automatic that the right thing to do was to do a lockdown, that there was a price to be paid if we did lockdowns. And they saw Doug Ford struggle with that, and they appreciated his struggle. And when they looked at the liberal critique, they just didn't feel that the liberals understood them. Now, one of the questions that I've got, that this is a new thing for us, right? This is, that graffiti just went up. And so we weren't inspired to ask that question earlier. But one of the questions in my mind is to what degree has this got worse for the liberals as a result of the federal liberal response to the Freedom Convoy? Right, because the Freedom Convoy, there are some pretty radical people that are part of the organizers, right, that were leaders of this thing that don't represent very many Canadians. But a lot of Canadians were sympathetic to the underlying issue of, has the government gone too far?
You also found that Doug Ford added his personal supporters, people who are not PC voters but support him individually, right, to his base. What role did they play in the PC party's victory?
They were critical, and they're different. So, there was this image of Ford Nation in the lead up to the 2018 election, that they were sort of a bunch of angry old white guys. And once you talk about a Ford personal vote, there's an image that's going to come to mind, for lack of better words, to the laptop class. But the reality of his personal vote is that it's quite moderate. It comes from people that are not fiscal conservatives, people that welcome things like energy transition. And they're people that like his style, that like the, they view him as somebody that's compassionate, caring, and willing to admit when he's wrong and respond to that. And in many regards, they're people that are attracted to what in the marketing world we would call brand trust. So brand trust in the marketing world is a belief that the company or organization that you're dealing with cares about what you think, listens to what you says, does what it can to respond to what you say, and reliably does that, that it's not a hit and miss thing, but that they will consistently do that. And what Doug Ford has built is a customer service ideology, right? The, you know, and this goes a long way back, the whole bit about them handing out their phone numbers and, you know, then the Toronto Star trying to catch them when they actually get elected and saying, you know, oh, surely they're not going to keep answering the phone, yet they do, right? And being the type of person that on a snow day jumps into his truck and goes to help people on an individual level, which a lot of people write off as sort of like hokey, but that, you know, this group of people, somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 7 Ontarians, views as a true reflection of his underlying character. It's who this guy really is. And having someone as premier that thinks you as a voter is important is something that voters appreciate.
I don't think they thought the effort to get out there and help people was hokey. I think they thought the teeny tiny little shovel was hokey.
Sure. But
that's a different story.
Sure, there you go.
We've talked Tories, we've talked Liberals. We should spend some time here on the NDP. And I think the narrative that's sort of emerged from the campaign is Horvath went into this thing with 40 seats. She came out of it with 31 seats, obviously a bad night for her. Your numbers seem to suggest that she was polling ahead of her party and that the NDP shouldn't be too quick to think that they're going to do better than her next time, right?
Sure. I mean, there are three things to say about their campaign. The first thing is that at least they had a ballot question that made sense, right? So the NDP was going into this campaign trying to convince people that Ontario needed real change and that the Liberals were just Tories lights. And that made a lot of sense. Like if you look at the underlying numbers, there was potential for that to work. And it was honestly the only road that could have got the NDP to overtake the other two parties. But tactically, they just couldn't make it stick. They couldn't get people talking about it. And probably in large part because a lot of people had made up their minds a year ago and just weren't that interested in hearing more by the time the campaign started. The second thing is that Horvath was diminished in this campaign compared to previous campaigns. There was, you know, she led the three leaders as most negative. And that is not at all how she was seen in previous election campaigns. And that's something that the Tories take some credit for, right? If you listen to the Tories talk about the campaign, they'll say that they had her number in the last election and they just never stopped, that they just kept pushing on that. And, you know, you could see that with the Yes Express. I mean, that was clearly begging the question. I think we talked about that at the start of the election. So while she's diminished from where she was in the previous campaign, she was still well above the Liberal leader as best to be premier. And she was competitive with Ford on things like caring and change, which Del Duca was not. Yet only, you know, depending on the polls, somewhere between 13 and 17% of Ontarians wake up in the morning and feel like New Democrats. So she, all the way through her time as leader, reached out and pulled in people that did not feel like New Democrats, particularly Liberals. And there's no guarantee that a new leader for the NDP is going to be able to do that. Now, there is some sign, if you look at the actual results and the fact that they did lose some seats. And if you look at the seats they lost, right, which were not not to Liberals, but to Tories, there's a big issue that the NDP is going to need to address in the leadership, which is the sort of lunchbox New Democrats versus the woke New Democrats. And, you know, the Tories were successful in lunchbox type seats. not all of them, right? So they did well in Thunder Bay and Timmins and Windsor, but they couldn't break through in Hamilton or in London.
No, they got Hamilton, Stony Creek.
Yeah. Well, Stony Creek is a sort of traditional, it's like a suburban seat in Hamilton, right? It's got large rural lots and things like that. So it is not, maybe the managers at the steel mill live there, but I'm not sure that the workers do. So so when you look at that, it's, and there is some science. So we're in the field just finishing off a post-election study now. And the issue is that it's a small number of voters when you look across the province. But when we looked at New Democrats that have, for lack of a better word, lunchbox or hard hat jobs, we do see a significant bleed of those voters from the last election to this election to the Tories. So it's just that it's relatively few voters on a province-wide basis, so it's hard to really document that on province-wide polls. But every when I look at the aggregate pattern, when I look at what I'm seeing in the post-election study, it says to me that the Tories told us they were trying to win those sort of voters, and there's evidence that they were successful at that. And as I would presume, all else being equal, that the Liberals will likely do better in the next election campaign, because their big problem was that they just couldn't get Liberals to vote Liberal. And that is the easiest of the challenges among the three parties to fix. No guarantee they'll do it. I mean, maybe Del Duca was their Ignatieff and the next person's going to be their Dion, or, they may mess up the leadership a second time and have to take a third kick at it before they get this right. But strategically, their problem is the easiest problem of the three parties. So if the Liberals are moving up and taken away from the NDP on their left flank, and the Tories continue the push with the lunch bucket set, they could lose even more seats, not just to the Liberals, but also more to the Tories.
It's a bit dangerous to use the word permanent when we're discussing politics and the trends in politics. But we've talked about the Tories eating the NDP lunch, whether that's lunchbox or a hard hat. Do you think that the Ford Tories have made permanent inroads into the labor world, specifically these private sector unions, in a way that would keep them from ever going back to the NDP?
Not yet. And the issue is, although, this is something that we still have to document a bit further. So the sign of a permanent change, or a relatively permanent change in political sense, is when party identification changes, right? So what marketers would call brand affinity. So when those people working in assembly lines, working in construction, what have you, working for private sector trade unions, start to tell us in the polls that when I say, what party do you feel closest to, start saying PC. And they don't say that yet, because part of this is personal to Doug Ford, right? And it's not yet necessarily reflected in the party. And that takes time and events, right? So it's the sort of showdowns that you saw with COVID, where there's a tough choice and there's real pressure to blink, and you don't blink, you pick the hard hat over the woke. And if you do that time and time again, then those people change teams. But it's, they've been feeling like New Democrats for a long time, and it's a big thing to stop feeling like that. But one thing that shows sign of being permanent, that's a bigger issue and will matter in the next federal election, is that we did see that change in party identification in the federal election between the Liberals and the Tories. So prior to the call of the election in Ontario, provincially, the Liberals on any given day had a 10-point lead in party affinity, which made it very hard for any Tory leader to ever win. And then the election call itself turned out to be the last straw for about 5% of the electorate. So about 1 in 20 people stopped feeling like Liberals and started feeling like Tories. But that has huge repercussions, because it takes a 10-point lead in party affinity and makes it virtually a tie. we're seeing, you know, typically maybe the Liberals now provincially have a 2-point lead. And what happens federally doesn't always translate into Ontario politics. It often doesn't. But this time it did. But that's the other thing that people need to bear in mind, is that this was a federally driven change. And while COVID really shattered the Tory coalition in the last federal election, COVID probably won't be there next time. And so whoever gets to win that federal Tory leadership is going to benefit from that underlying change in party affinity, which has been stable since the last federal election campaign. So when we think about the changes and the ability of the Tories to sustain the gains they receive, we should understand that there's some fundamental changes to the foundations of Ontario politics that make it easier for the Tories to hold on than prior to the last federal election campaign. So you had both a change in the party brand and a change in the leader's brand come together to put the Tories in a very strong position with a campaign that clearly worked, right? I mean, they were very focused on trying to get the perfect split of the vote between the opposition, right? If either one of those parties started to look like they were building up ahead of steam, the Tories shifted to attack the party that looked like it had even a little momentum. And, you know, you can't argue with the results, right? I mean, it's a virtual tie. The Liberals are like 0.1% of a percent ahead of the NDP on the current counts.
It's as perfect a split of the opposition as I think we've ever seen in this province.
Yeah, so even though people weren't paying a lot of attention, just the management of the campaign to keep enough wind in their own sails while denying the wind to the opponents was not as easy as it sounds.
Greg, we always appreciate your visits to our little podcast. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we would normally do quotes of the week right now, but after the election campaign, provincial politicians have been unsurprisingly taking a bit of a break in front of the microphone, so no press conferences from the premier or the two opposition leaders who've announced they're stepping down anyway, so we're just going to give you a break on quotes of the week, and we'll just ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We do love your feedback, as you know, good, bad, or indifferent.
Or you can shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org. Or you can tweet at us, like Dan did. He writes, "While the results stung, Ontario should count itself lucky that it had access to the daily election coverage provided by J.M. McGrath, S. Paikin, and their team at TVO. In an age of hyperbolic media, it's refreshing to listen to journalists who practice restraint and provide nuance."
That's really quite lovely. Thank you for that, Dan. And just to let everybody know, you can hammer us and we'll mention that on the podcast as well. It doesn't all have to be sweetness and light, but I confess I don't mind the sweetness and light at all.
Send all the negative criticism to Steve, though.
Right on.
We also want to remind you to read our weekly On Poly newsletter, which drops every Tuesday. You can subscribe to that at tvo.org/newsletters. This week, we've got the NDP under the microscope as we consider its future with a new leader and perhaps a new mission.
And that is the On Poly podcast for this Tuesday, June the 14th, 2022. This week's episode was produced by Tiffany Lamb and Katie O'Connor, edited by Matthew O'Mara, production support from Nikki Ashworth, Jonathan Hallowell, and Albert Wisco. JMM, I guess we're back to my old tagline. As my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.